Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today I am joined by Paul Harvey, professor of history and a presidential teaching scholar at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. He researches, writes, and teaches in the field of American history from the 16th century to the present. Professor Harvey is the creator and blogmeister of the nationally known scholarly blog Religion in American History, and is also the contributor to the online journal Religion Dispatches. He is the author and or editor of 11 books, count them 11, including Through the Storm, Through the Night, A History of African American Christianity, Redeeming the South, Religious Cultures and Racial Identities Among Southern Baptists, 1865 to 1925, Freedom's Coming, Religious Cultures and the Shaping of the South from the Civil War through the Civil Rights Era, The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Saga of Race in American History, co-written with Edward Bloom, and most recently, Christianity and Race in the American South, which will be the focus of our discussion today. He will also be releasing a new book entitled Bounds of Their Habitation, Religion and Race in American History in the forthcoming year. He also writes lots of articles, and you can find out more about his prodigious scholarly output over at his own website, paulharvey.org, which we will link at our website, www.researchonreligion.org. So get on over to that newfangled internet thingy and check it out. I'm sure many of you got the internet for Christmas. So, Paul, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you.
So, because I'm a big fan of origin stories like that of Batman, Iron Man, Spider-Man, and Wolverine, I have to ask how such a mild-mannered college student from Oklahoma Baptist University ends up as a super scholar studying the topic of religion and race in the American South.
Sure. Actually, I was kind of a hellion as a college student. You might want to check with the dean of students who was there at the time about that. But
you said hellion or Hegelian?
Hellion.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure I knew what a Hegelian was.
No, I took a class in Hegel, too, and I didn't know what that was either. So,
Sure. First of all, can I just say one thing about Bounds of Their Habitation? That book is actually out. It just came out literally the same week as this book, Christianity and Race in the American South, came out. So that's available for your purchase, just so your audience will know that.
No, that's good. We'll link
by Roman and Littlefield.
Yeah, we'll link to all your books on our website. And I was looking at your website for the bio, and it didn't say it was coming out till 2017.
Yeah, the book lists, it actually has a copyright of 2017, but it's available on Amazon or any place else. You can buy it now.
Sneaky how they do that.
I have a copy of it right here, as a matter of fact. I grew up in the Oklahoma Panhandle, northwest Oklahoma, which at the time was a 100% white part of the country. That's no longer the case. And I grew up as a very strong Southern Baptist and was a rather devout as a young person, and in fact served as a kind of a volunteer missionary to Brazil when I was 14, 15 years old. So at some level that has everything to do with my scholarship, and at another level it doesn't have anything to do with it, because during college and the first 2 years of which I was a biology major actually, and then after college when I made my way to California, I was not interested in this subject at all. And I was not really interested in it academically until I started studying with Leon Litwack, professor of history at Berkeley, famous professor of African American history. And he basically showed me why it was an important and interesting, Southern history in general, not religion specifically, but Southern history in general, why it was an interesting and an important topic. And once I got into that, and I wanted to write an integrated history of the South. Southern history is often seen as kind of white history, and then there's this separate thing called black history, which doesn't have to do with Southern history, and that seemed to me ridiculous. And so my goal all along was to write racially integrated American histories and Southern histories. So I really got into it when I was in California in graduate school, even though there's some kind of deep background part of me that was into it.
And did you get any pushback when you talked about wanting to study religion? I know that both you and I are pretty much of the same era, and you know, back in the 80s and 90s, people thought religion was somewhat of a dead topic, secularization theory and all, washing through the academy. But when you approached your advisor and wanted to study religion, did they embrace it, or did they say, try something else?
No, quite the opposite. In fact, he suggested it.
Oh, very cool.
And, you know, the reason is because it's interesting in history, because what happened in the field of history is once social history arose in the 1960s and 70s, the premise of which is what ordinary people do is important. And, of course, what ordinary people do in American history is they're very religious very often. And so if you're going to take social history seriously, then religious history is just naturally going to arise from that. And that was basically happening, I would say, starting in the 60s and 70s and 80s, even though at the time we have something now that we just call American religious history, and it's considered a field in and of itself. And we didn't have that at the time. There wasn't a field called American religious history. So I did Southern history, which happened to be about religion, but I didn't think of it as American religious history. It was really only in the 90s, thanks to a lot of grant money that was available at the time, that the field that, as it exists now, sort of conceptualized itself, I guess. But no, I didn't get any pushback. It was all encouragement. I had a wonderful experience in graduate school, I have to say.
No, that's great. In political science and economics, a little bit different, but it's good to see that the historians are embracing the fact that people in their everyday lives are actually kind of religious. Go figure. Now, you've written a number of books on race and religion in the American South, and so you're sticking to a relatively consistent substantive theme over the past few decades. How has your own work evolved in terms of the questions that you're asking and the things that you're finding from your way back first book to now?
Yeah, I think the first book was really much more of a institutionally oriented. That's not as often the case with first books because they have archives and you know how to do research on that kind of stuff. Much more narrowly focused topic, as is typical of dissertation first books. And then as I've gone ahead, the questions have not changed so much as they've broadened. And I've thought of myself much more as a cultural historian now than I probably did in earlier days. And the time period has broadened such that my recent books have been sort of all of American history since European settlement. But the driving questions of how have race and religion interacted in American history have at some level always been at the heart of these, even though I'm much more self-conscious about those questions now than I was at the origin. But that's obviously been a consistent substantive theme, as you say here.
Yeah, your new book, Christianity and Race in the American South, is very broad. And so, as you mentioned, questions are broadening, and you're including a lot of things that people would not necessarily think about religion in the American South, including Spanish Catholics in the mid-16th century, and then ending up, for the most part, your book ends up in the early 21st century here with a mention of the killing spree at the Emmanuel AME Church in June of 2015. And the murder of those churchgoers was recently sentenced in Charleston, South Carolina. So it's quite an amazing case, and it's interesting that you bookend your book here around that. The other thing that's really interesting about the Charleston, South Carolina killings was that, and this astounded many observers too, is that many of the survivors of that AME church shooting actually extended their grace and forgiveness to the killer shortly after the event. And so we see this theme recently of tragedy and healing all wrapped up into this story. Has that been a major theme running throughout the history of Christianity and race in America?
Yeah, more tragedy than healing, honestly. But the Charleston incident, I was originally going to end this book with Katrina. In fact, the book at the time was called Trouble the Waters when I was writing it, because it was going to be about sort of troubled waters from Jamestown and death in Jamestown because of bad water to Katrina. And then as I was rewriting, I'd actually turned in the first version of the manuscript, got sent back to me with some reviewers' comments, and I was rewriting it. And then literally in the midst of rewriting it, the Charleston incident happened, and I knew immediately that that was the end of the book. I should say the Dylann Roof was just convicted, but he hasn't been sentenced yet. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the sentence, because, of course, it's going to come down to whether the death penalty is applied or not. And that has everything to do with these themes of grace and forgiveness and all that stuff that you just mentioned before.
Now, what are some of the major continuities that run throughout history? I mean, again, you're going back to Jamestown. You're actually even going back further than Jamestown to Spanish colonization in Florida, and we'll talk about that in a second. But from that period, so 500 years or so forward to now, are there any continuities that you've sniffed out?
Yeah, the book is really more about discontinuities, transformations, and fractures than it is about continuities, I would say, because one of my points is sort of major transformations of Southern history that make the South a totally different place from one era to a different era. However, that being said, the continuity that this has always been a multiracial region from its very outset, and not only whites from Europe and blacks from Africa, but also, of course, native peoples and different kinds of Europeans and all that kind of stuff. And so it was always a multicultural, multiracial region, but also a region in which there was a very strongly defined sense of hierarchy defined through race and religion. And that was true in the early days in Florida, of course. Obviously, it was true of 17th century Virginia with the Anglicans and going on forward even up to the Evangelical Challenge. Despite their democratic rhetoric, they eventually came to terms with conceiving of a society organized hierarchically through race. And that's always been a continuity, I think.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about some of the discontinuities and changes as we walk through the history of this period and through your book. But one of the things that you also do with your work here and some of your recent work, and you've hinted at this a few moments ago, was to blend different streams of analysis in Southern cultural history or Southern history more generally. Give us a sense for what different streams there are in Southern history and what you're attempting to do, blending them together.
Sure. A couple of different things that I'm trying to do here. First of all, in this book, I'm really trying to blend a different fields of history together. For example, political history is part of it, as is cultural history, as is religious history, as is economic history. And so when you look at the early 19th century, for example, the vast expansion into the Deep South with about a million African American people taken in the internal slave trade from the Upper South to the Lower South, has everything to do with Indian land expropriation, and it has everything to do with the booming Southern economy, and which has everything to do with the vast expansion of evangelicalism. And I try to tell all of, and that vast expansion of evangelicalism has everything to do with developing what becomes the fundamentals of Southern evangelical culture, which I think really takes shape during the antebellum era. So I try to put all of those different currents of history together and tell them at the same time. And another thing that I'm trying to do is re-periodize Southern history, especially Southern religious history, so that there's a distinct era of Southern history that is pre-evangelical, and that has everything to do with its connections to the Caribbean world, much more so than it has to do with connections to Europe even. That's about a 200 year period of Southern history that has to be seen as in its own integrity. And then you have the evangelical era, which I think is about a 200 year era. And I think we're now moving into, not there yet, but gradually moving into a post-evangelical era of the South that I think will be much more evident, let's say, about, you know, in the next 30 to 50 years. And so the last chapter is about contemporary pluralism in the South. I'm trying to put Southern evangelicalism into its proper historical period and context, and look at what was before and look what will probably be after that.
One of the other things that you do very well in this book is to blend different historical approaches in terms of what you're looking at. You mentioned that previous scholars would look at evangelicals acting upon others, and then there would be another track of social historians that look at the undervoiced or the people who, without any voice. You're actually trying to establish a dialogue here between these two streams. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, the discussion in the field of history has, you know, social history came up and you're supposed to pay attention to ordinary people, all that stuff that I just talked about before. And then more recently, people came back and said, no, wait a minute. Some people have power, some people don't. And there is this thing called the state, and they're political actors who are the elites, and they actually exercise power. You can't just ignore them. And so there's been a sort of yin and yang back and forth between the bottom-up and top-down approaches to history in that way. I think there always will be. That's just natural to the discipline. And I'm interested in trying to tell both those stories at the same time. And so and I try to do it by picking, when I can, particular biographical actors. So I talk about Charles Jones, an elite planter in the Lowcountry of Georgia and South Carolina, who becomes the so-called apostle to the slaves, and his family is hugely important for the history of the Lowcountry, and certainly a very elite actor in every religious, political way that you can conceive. But he has all these interactions with the so-called voiceless, and the voiceless talk back to him, and they let him know when they don't like stuff that he says in his sermons, and that they're not going to come hear him if he keeps saying that. He's not happy about that. But he stopped saying it because they're not going to come hear him if he keeps talking about slaves obey your masters and that kind of thing. So that's, as much as possible, I try to talk about those two sides in interaction with one another. Because one of the themes of the book is this incredible cruelty and inequality and racism that's a deep part of Southern history. And at the same time, the fact that this is a region that fundamentally creates the things that we think of as American culture, especially musical culture, and literary culture in the 20th century. And so there's this paradox of cruelty and creativity that I think is fundamental to Southern history that I find quite fascinating.
You mentioned the region of the South, and before we move into the history, give us an idea of the territory that we're talking about here. I think we kind of know what it is. Mm-hmm. Is it a geographic area? Is it a cultural area? Is it both? What is it?
It's both. And so one of the things about this book is it's premised on the notion of a particular geography known as the American South. But this thing, of course, does not exist until the middle of the 19th century. The Civil War basically creates the South as a unit. And so the book is premised on something that has to come into existence, and the first half of the book is basically talking about how does this particular geographic cultural region come into existence, and what is the role of religion in making it come into existence. And so and it's defined here as, you know, the Confederate South, along with Kentucky and Missouri and some of the non-Confederate slave-owning states. So basically what we conventionally think of as the South is what you would assume is what I'm talking about in the book. But one of the points of the book is this is something that's commonsensical to us, but would not have been known to anyone prior to, let's say, the middle of the 19th century. And so it has to be discussed as a historical development.
Let's go ahead and look at that historical development and jump back prior to the Civil War, the creation of the South, and take us deep into history. The first thing that surprises me about the book is how deep it actually goes back in history. I said, oh, you're going to go back to, oh, I don't know, colonial times, maybe the 18th century. But you dip way back into the middle of the 16th century and talk about the initial settlement phase of the South with the Spaniards in La Florida. Tell us about that.
Sure. So, first of all, the Spanish show up before the English do. That's important. People who study the early history of Hispano-America are always going nuts when we talk about the Puritans and other people who come later. But I think what's important about it is First of all, Florida is obviously would be considered in the northern part of the Spanish Empire. Much of New Mexico would have been in that period would have been called northern Mexico. And so the very fact that that is the case indicates that the South is already a misnomer for that particular period of history. But I think what's important about Florida is it's all about the English and Spanish and Protestant versus Catholic competition. That's really why Florida is important from the European perspective. From the native perspective, I think it's important because it begins to show some of the complicated ways in which European and native peoples are going to be interacting with one another. So I talked in the first part of the book about the Spanish in Florida, and what eventually ends up happening over the course of about 150 years is the English and Spanish conflict comes to Florida, which very tragically produces massive slave trade in Indian peoples. There's actually a larger slave trade of Indian peoples in the late 17th, early 18th century than there is in African peoples sold in the slave markets of Charleston, for example. And most of those people are basically dragged away from Florida.
So in terms of Catholicism and the Spaniards in relation to the indigenous populations there at the time, how did religion play in there? Were there efforts to missionize them? Were they just ignored? What was going on?
Yeah, there were absolutely efforts to missionize them. So characteristic of the Spanish in various parts of the New World, a lot of military people came to take over the place and to guard against English intrusions and so forth, especially in Florida. And then a lot of priests came along with them. And so the priest established all these doctrinas, these kind of mission villages all over the place. And at one particular mission village I'm talking about, there was actually an organ there that Indians were taught to play. And so they were playing Spanish Catholic hymns, basically. And there was a kind of routinized Catholic order in those particular places. Now, periodically, Indians would rise up and revolt against them. And so early Florida is a kind of history of the establishment of Spanish missions, followed by Indian revolts against them, followed by the reestablishment of the missions, and it sort of goes back and forth like that for about 100 years.
So that goes on for 100 years, and the...
More than 100 years.
More than 100.
140 years, more or less.
And the British start coming in, too, in the early part of the 17th century, and you mentioned Jamestown as one of the bookmarkers for this. And how does the arrival of the British start to change the religious landscape known as the South?
Yeah, so the British come. They are obviously bringing Anglicanism. And one thing that I think is important about early Virginia is for a long time, historians had thought about kind of New England was the religious colony, set of colonies, and the South was a kind of non-religious, mercantile, or money-grubbing set of colonies. But that's not entirely untrue, but it's not entirely true either, because there was a really strongly Protestant conception that went into the establishment of Virginia, and there really was a thought of kind of not exactly a city upon a hill like you would think of with New England, but of bringing the light of Christ to the New World, and there was serious conceptions of Christianizing the Indians in Virginia and all that sort of stuff very much played into it. But also played into it is the English wanted to get a hold there so that the Spanish wouldn't be able to get a hold. And really, Virginia and Spanish North America are very much at war with each other for, you know, the first long period of American history. And religion was very much a part of those wars.
When it comes to this era, the 1600s, we get the introduction of slavery, African-American slavery here. And how does religion factor into this? Do we see the same kind of things that the Spaniards were doing? Let's missionize these new people, these others, so to speak, and make them of our own. Or what is going on with the British in terms of slavery?
Yeah, so the British began to bring in slaves, mostly from their colonies, and not really from Africa, mostly from their colonies in the Caribbean. And it's somewhat of an afterthought, actually, because the labor force is largely white indentured servants up until about the 1660s, 1670s. Slavery really begins to take hold as a major institution, I would say, beginning in about the 1680s, 1690s. That's also the same period in which people begin to think about what does it mean to bring in all of these so-called heathen peoples. In fact, many of them, some of them at least, would have been Christianized in Africa. They would have been Catholic Christians and things like that. But they were Africans, therefore they were heathens. And could they be Christians? Was Christianity just for white people? They begin to debate all of these kinds of questions. And they begin to formulate legal codes around them. For example, historically, if someone was baptized and became a Christian, then they could not be a slave. That obviously was not going to work in a slave society. You had to be able to Christianize slaves as well as keep them as slaves. And so legal codes began to work all that out. And it was pretty well established by starting in the 1660s, but certainly by the 1705 Virginia Slave Code that defined exactly who was a free person and who wasn't, and defined that if the mother was a slave, then the child of the mother would be a perpetual slave. Didn't matter whether or not they were baptized or not, and defined various penalties for interracial relationships and that kind of thing. And all of these had to be worked out because the English recognized that there was a problem with their historic conception of Christianity and freedom. It just wasn't going to work in the environment of Virginia and in South Carolina.
There are a lot of tensions that do arise here as you're trying to Christianize individuals. The message of Christianity can be very liberating, and yet you're talking this to a slave community. Is the message that's getting to them changed in such a way to justify slavery? And are there any reactions to this? You talk about something called the Stono Rebellion, and
yeah.
Put all this into context for us.
Yeah, so it's very complicated because, yeah, the message... They do begin to formulate what we would later call a pro-slavery theology, even though it was very rudimentary at the time. But they also formulate ideas that African-descended peoples are peoples with souls. They're not separately created peoples. They're not something different than what we would read about from who they descended from Adam and Eve like everyone else. Therefore, they could be Christianized like everyone else. But the message had to be, you know, what does spiritual freedom mean in the context of a slave society? It doesn't mean that you're no longer a slave. Of course, you're still a slave. It's just that you have spiritual freedom. So they began to work all that kind of stuff out. Meanwhile, there was a reaction to that, obviously, early on in various slave communities. And so one of those that I talk about was the Stono Rebellion in South Carolina in 1739. Which historians now understand as arising from various African Catholic traditions from the Portuguese part of Africa, and that the Angola, basically, which is where most people in South Carolina were coming from. And they had their own ideas of the relationship of Christianity and freedom. And they also wanted to get to Florida because the Spanish were saying, come here, become a member of the Spanish military, and we will free you because we want you as soldiers to fight against the English, and the English are enslaving you, and we'll give you freedom as long as you become a Catholic and join the military. So the Spanish really had a traditional, that's kind of what always happens with slaves in human history, is they use the military to gain their freedom. It's unusual that North America, the English North America, is one place where that doesn't happen, even during the Civil War. That's really unusual for the history of slave societies.
The next major period that you identify extends from the First Great Awakening in the mid-18th century and roughly through the Second Great Awakening, or say around 1800, maybe the 1810s or up to that period. What is going on in terms of this era? It's the revolutionary era. It's the creation of a new government. Slavery is still in existence in the South. How does religion play out in all this?
Sure. So this chapter is called The Revolutionaries and the Revivalists, because I see those are the two streams of Southern history. So the revolutionaries would be the people that we would think of as the Virginia Founding Fathers, the Thomas Jefferson generation, and who are largely not very pious people. They may be conventionally Anglican like George Washington, or they may be sort of vaguely providentialist like Thomas Jefferson, but not really believing that Jesus was a divine person and that kind of thing. But they form an alliance, obviously, with the revivalists, who are bringing the evangelical message to the South beginning in about the mid to late 18th century. and who are preaching to the same message to white and black people together, who want to be able to practice religious freedom. They don't want to have to pay tax. They don't want to have to be jailed if they're a Baptist preacher and that kind of thing. And Thomas Jefferson and James Madison are also horrified by that. So they form an alliance that eventuates in the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom and later on in the First Amendment to the Constitution. Even though they're polar opposites in terms of theology, because Thomas Jefferson hated evangelicalism, Presbyterianism especially, he hated. He famously writes to the Baptists in Connecticut in 1802, thanking them for their support for his presidential campaign and writing about the wall of separation between church and state. A lot of people think that's in the Constitution, but it's actually in the 1802 letter.
Mm-hmm. In terms of race relations in the South, one of the things that occurs in the middle part of the 18th century and extends forward even into the early part of the 19th century is the Great Awakening period. Mm-hmm. And you have itinerant missionaries wandering throughout the countryside, and it's more than likely that they're going to come across plantations and meet slaves. Is there anything, any kind of outreach that occurs with the black population in these Great Awakenings?
Yeah, so there is in both so-called Great Awakenings, if you want to use that conventional designation, the first Great Awakening of the 18th century and second Great Awakening of the first half of the 19th century, more or less. So the second Great Awakening happens at exactly the same moment that the South, the Deep South that we think of, Mississippi, Alabama, places like that, are being settled, and large numbers of white people are coming to settle it, and they are bringing large numbers of African slaves with them or purchasing them from the Upper South, and religious missionaries are following in their wake. Evangelical missionaries are traveling, especially Methodists are itinerating all over the place. People like Charles Jones are beginning to form the Liberty County Association for the Religious Instruction of the Negroes, and there's a lot of groups like that, because their idea is it was incumbent upon them to bring the Christian message to a heathen, African, uncivilized population. That's really how Charles Jones saw it. And so that entire movement to missionize among the slaves of the antebellum South really takes off in the 1830s and becomes characteristic of the rest of the antebellum era. And to a very large degree, this is really when African American Christianity as a force begins to take hold, largely because slaves do hear the message, but of course they take the message, they hear the message in their own way, and they create their own religious sentiments and their own religious ideologies out of that.
What would constitute some of that? Give us a flavor for what that would constitute relative to, say, your typical white Presbyterian church.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of it actually would be the same. For example, black Baptist churches exercise church discipline just like white Baptist churches do. That is, if you're a drunkard, you're going to get kicked out of the church, that kind of thing. So I would say, you know, a good half of it would look pretty much exactly the same. But then what is the ultimate outcome of this message? Blacks obviously saw that ultimate outcome that would eventuate in freedom. Whites really saw it that it would eventuate in order, and those two things in contrast, the ideas of freedom as fundamental versus the idea of order as fundamental, I think really is the basic contrast between white Southern evangelicalism and black Southern evangelicalism.
One of the other things that you bring up here too in your book, again, it's a rather untold story, is Native Americans at the time. You mentioned that there's a Native American awakening, and that kind of surprised me. I thought, well, they've been pushed westward, they've been out of there, but they're still around in the South, and they're playing an important role in shaping the religious landscape. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I really wanted to bring that part in. In an earlier, longer version of this book, there was actually more of that, and I talked about it more in the 20th century as well, and I had to, unfortunately, cut some of that material out. But scholars refer to now an Indian Great Awakening, meaning basically Indian peoples who had been, would historically have conceptualized themselves as completely different peoples, members of different tribes, therefore you're just a completely different person. And Indians in the 18th century are coming to understand themselves as Indian peoples in a sort of pan-Indian sense. And so that's one of the meanings of Indian Awakening is that. Another of the meanings is they are also affected by the Great Awakening. Some are Christianized and some are going to react against that Christianization in the early 19th century. And many Indian communities in the Southeast are very much split over that because those who were Christianized also begin to participate in the Southern slave economy. So Cherokees and other groups become plantation owners and slave owners. Later on take those slaves to Oklahoma when they're forced to move there. Christianity and native religions are really interacting in interesting ways through this entire period. And it's pretty fundamental to the history because, after all, they were the people who were there on the land to begin with. And in order for the South to emerge in the way that we think of as the South, they, as white settlers conceived it, they had to be removed. And Andrew Jackson and others proceed to do that.
Are there any types of religious justifications that are made for this removal?
Yeah, actually, it's a complex story because, of course, some evangelical missionaries who come from the North and settle amongst Native American communities are bitterly opposed to removal, and bitterly opposed to Andrew Jackson, and file court cases against it, and this becomes the famous Supreme Court cases of the 1830s. So that's one side of it is kind of evangelicals' defense of native rights. Okay, and then the other side of it is a broadly conceived cultural mission, as many white Protestants would have seen it, of bringing civilization to places. This meant Christianizing Africans, and it meant removing natives. And this all becomes part of manifest destiny ideas of the 19th century. And ultimately, they win the day over those who were opposed to them, including the evangelical missionaries who were opposed to them.
I can imagine that this creates a lot of tension within Christianity as a broad umbrella, There's another tension that occurs within Christianity, too, that arises over the Civil War. And this is a major era in American history, too, where you have Quakers and others who are very anti-slavery versus, you know, Southern evangelicals that are justifying slavery. How does this all play out during the Civil War era?
Yeah, so the Civil War comes. The Civil War is fundamentally about slavery. And the entire Southern evangelical apparatus and the mission to the slaves and all that stuff that had come about becomes a fundamental part of justifying not only the war, not only slavery, but also the war and of defending the so-called Southern homeland, Southern way of life. In fact, the Southern way of life as a phrase comes to be used around that time, really for the first time as a phrase. Religion becomes a fundamental part of Southern identity, and the Civil War and the post-Civil War years make it much more so because they have to explain what they had just gone through. They have a lot of suffering and death to explain, for example. And in order to explain that, they look to the Bible verses which point to, you know, the trials and tribulations that God's people have to go through in order to purify themselves. And that's essentially how they explain the results of the Civil War.
And you mentioned that this is the time where we start to gain a conception of what the South is, not only through the Civil War, where there's a line that is drawn saying you're on this side or that side, but even in the Reconstruction era, you start to see this identity of the South being created. And what are some of the ways that religion plays into forming this identity?
Yeah, I think religion fundamentally plays into it because one of the things that I just talked about is how do you interpret the Civil War? It takes an entire generation for people to work this out, but the idea of the lost cause, for example, and the idea of a noble Christian civilization that had to be defended even if it was probably inevitably doomed to defeat in some way, all of that kind of stuff And the idea of the South as a kind of Bible Belt and as a purer version of an America that was rapidly pluralizing and getting all kinds of strange Jewish and Catholic people coming to the Northeast, and the South would sort of represent what was more historically pure American. All that stuff is happening in the late 19th century, and Southern Christianity is very much a part of that. I should say, of course, the other side of that is African American Christians obviously had a very different idea about what the Civil War meant, and they, as they saw it, their providential idea of freedom was the one that won out. And so I often go into Civil War classes and it's like, did the South lose the war? And of course they say yes. And I said, well, 60% of South Carolinians were black. Did they lose the war? No, of course they didn't. They won the war in a sense. So I think that is an important part of the story as well.
And how do these two streams of Christianity, both the white evangelicals and the African-American view of providence and freedom, and maybe even the Exodus story becoming very important here, How do those interact with one another? Do they not interact? Is there more segregation going on? Are there tensions? What's happening here?
That's a hard question to answer exactly. But I would say after, there's much more interaction before the war because they're in churches together, because whites are bringing their slaves to church, making them sit in the balconies and that kind of thing. After the war, you obviously have the creation of entirely separate religious institutions and denominations for blacks. And so in some sense, there's much less of that kind of interaction. And so they develop, their different ideas institutionally, and those institutions come to represent, in a sense, those ideas. So if you read the convention minutes, let's say, of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1900 versus the National Baptist Convention, which is the Black Baptist Convention, and they're talking about totally different stuff, really, even though theologically they would align with most points. They have a pretty similar evangelical theology, but how to apply that socially is completely different.
What are some of the different themes that are emphasized in these two different strands of American baptism?
Black Baptists talk about their status as a people and their citizenship rights, which are constantly under threat and constantly being eroded through the course of the late 19th, early 20th century, and they talk about lynchings and all those kinds of things. White Baptists are really talking about sort of their role as the preservers of the purity of America, and they're kind of the last best hope for America and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of that as well in Southern Methodism and Southern Presbyterianism. So they see themselves as carrying, as the carriers of white Christian civilization in a nation that is losing that.
We next move into the early 20th century, and this is bringing some new trends here. We get urbanization, albeit it's a little bit slower in the South than in the North, but it's still happening. We mentioned there's segregation starting to occur during this period of time, as well as some new technologies. We start to see the advent of radio and music and phonographs and things like that. How is this transforming the religious landscape down South, and how is religion perhaps influencing socio-demographic trends during this time?
One thing that happens in the period of the 20th century as the rise of electronic media is the coming of Southern religious mores and cultural expressions to these electronic media. I know that you interviewed Lerone Martin and his book Preaching on Wax, which is just an amazing, wonderful book that's very influential on me. And he talks about, all these black preachers making records in the 1920s, and many of them were selling more records of their recorded sermons than were Bessie Smith selling records of her blues recordings, that kind of thing. So it's really an important part of that era. So one of the things I talk about in the 20th century is, how does Southern culture come to define American culture in certain kinds of ways? And there's a variety of answers to that, but one of the answers is Southern religious culture comes to define what we think of as authentically American, quote-unquote authentically American. And I think that happens through the course of the 20s, 30s, 40s, which is a time when Americans as a whole are being introduced to this kind of centuries-old tradition of Southern religious expression and are very much attracted to it.
What are some of the dimensions of this authentically American culture?
Well, we now call it Americana. We have an entire genre of music called Americana, or No Depression music, for example, that is understood to arise from kind of the folk, kind of ordinary people who make music in certain kind of ways. A lot of this is kind of made up because, of course, the early blues artists are very interested in making money and will record anything that they need to record in order to make money. So I'm using the word authentically in a bit of an ironic sense. But people understand a blues artist or a country musician or someone coming from a church tradition singing gospel music as kind of authentic in certain kinds of ways. And all of these things, and this of course becomes the fundamentals of American popular culture in the 50s and 60s through the lens of rock and roll and blues and all that kind of stuff. So I think Southern religion, and I haven't mentioned Pentecostalism yet, but Pentecostalism is a huge, huge part of this. It doesn't start in the South, but it becomes particularly influential in the South, and it becomes influential in terms of a certain kind of emotional expression that translates well into popular culture, especially popular musical culture. And so that to me is the relationship there of religion and American culture. Southern religion and American culture is through this lens of music and various other kinds of artistic expressions.
Now, one of the things that you bring up, and you mentioned this earlier in the podcast, is the paradoxes of the South at this time. We just talked about the emergence of the blues, these wonderful musical genres that are originating during this period of time. But also, there's a lot of literary figures. You have your Faulkners mm-hmm. and your Hemingways mm-hmm. during this period of time. Mixed in with a culture that also seems incredibly violent and backwards, how is all of this playing out in the first half of the 20th century?
It's playing out because they both play out at the same time, which is what makes it so fascinating. So I began that particular chapter, which is called Death is Riding All Through This Land, by talking about how do you explain the paradox of the novels of Faulkner or the short stories of Flannery O'Connor or the writings of the so-called Nashville agrarians of the 1930s, who were really inventing modernism in a literary sense. And how do you explain that with the fact that of the incredible violence of the South and the incredible poverty and the incredible racism and all the sort of negative stuff that we associate with Southern culture? And I don't know that we can explain it exactly, but I think I can explain something about the effects of that kind of tension are to produce certain kinds of art that has a particular power to it. And so that I think is part of what makes Southern cultural expression so powerful and so attractive to the rest of the country as it comes to be translated through literary means, through artists such as Howard Finster, folk artists such as Clementine Hunter, and through all of the musicians that people will be familiar with.
Could you give us some examples or flavors of how this really plays out, and perhaps some that have really resonated with you?
So one of them would be through the power of the religious expression in that you would find in Faulkner's novels, and in particular Absalom, Absalom, which is my favorite of his novels. And you just look at the title, Absalom, Absalom, and you get a sense of the biblical influence on that kind of story. And then if you look at the kinds of recordings that are being made in the 30s that people later in the 1960s pick up on and are looking to sort of inform the early years of the folk music movement of the 60s and rock and roll and all that kind of stuff. And so if you look at a figure like Geechee Wiley, or if you look at the early blues figures, or if you look at a figure like Hank Williams, who creates his own Hank Williams creates his own character called Luke the Drifter, because Hank himself was, of course, famously alcoholic, and Luke the Drifter was his kind of religious self talking to himself, delivering sermons to himself. So he often performs in the character of Luke the Drifter as a way to express his religious self. And Elvis Presley, of course, is famously influenced by black Pentecostal churches that he observes growing up in Tupelo, Mississippi, and then later on in Memphis. So we could go on and on with all these kinds of figures who are looking at religious expression and then trying to translate that to a secular world, even through secular lyrics, but are fundamentally doing religious music as they would have conceived it.
The religious world collides with the secular world of politics during this period of time, the middle part of the 20th century and the civil rights era. How does religion play out during this, and how does it reshape what we understand about the South?
Sure. So obviously, African-American religious expression is fundamental to the civil rights movement, and there's a long argument about this amongst various historians, because they'll say, if you read the letters of civil rights workers, they're always complaining about how churches are apathetic and they don't want to be part of the civil rights movement and so forth, and are very resistant to opening their churches up to civil rights meetings. All that's true. However, how else could the civil rights movement have energized its shock troops to do the things that they did if they were not infused with a very powerful religious belief that carried them through all the stuff that someone like John Lewis, for example, had to go through it in Selma, Alabama, and could go on with many other examples of that. And so one of the things that happens, I think, in the 60s is the power of the black religious tradition that many people had seen as kind of depoliticized after Reconstruction is, in a sense, recaptured. And I think it takes a genius like Martin Luther King to figure out how to marry the kind of emotional power of African-American religion together with the kind of intellectual formation from Reinhold Niebuhr and many others that he brings to the movement itself. And so I think the genius of the sermons is he brings both of those two things together, and that helps make the civil rights movement what it is. I think from the white side, it's very complicated because you have a fair degree of sympathy amongst many white denominational leaders for example, Brown versus Board, which the Southern Baptist Convention approves of. And at the same time, you have their kind of rank and file who are very much opposed to civil rights. And you begin to see a split, I think, of sort of denominational leaders versus the rank and file. And I think when you look at later on, movements of Southern fundamentalism, I think that's where it comes from. I think it comes from the splits that emerged from the civil rights years in the white church.
And this starts to play out in the post-civil rights era, and you talk about a number of trends that are occurring, say, roughly from the 1970s into the early 21st century. Maybe it's still affecting us today. And that's the rise of the religious right of the prosperity gospel, both in white and black evangelical churches. Mm-hmm. And then also another surprising trend, which is Latino religion is making its presence felt here in the last few decades. So talk about where we've been in the last, say, 50 years when it comes to religiosity in the South.
Yeah, so that chapter is subtitled Politics, Prosperity, and Pluralism. So the politics part is all of the controversies that emerged from the civil rights movement that I just mentioned a moment ago. The prosperity part is another of the paradoxes that this book talks about is here's this incredibly violent and impoverished region that takes to the prosperity gospel. And so there are per capita many more prosperity gospel churches in the South than there are in other regions of the country. And a figure like Oral Roberts, for example, and other people like Oral Roberts who are preaching that kind of theology become very important. And to me, that's pretty fascinating given the kind of places that they came from and given the kind of life difficulties that they came from. So that's the prosperity part of it. The pluralism part of it is just the very last part of the book where I talk about current demographic trends and immigration trends and Latino Catholicism is a big part of that. I would also say, by the way, Asian American religions and Asian Catholicism, especially Vietnamese Catholicism, is also a very important part of that. I mentioned I grew up in Oklahoma, and I was just there recently for my nephew's wedding, and there's an entire section of Oklahoma City, which is now called the Asian District, but it's really the Vietnamese District. It's about, I don't know, 40,000 or so people in this one particular district, and this was, you know, this is a brand new part of the South, and many southern cities have a kind of district like that, and it's full of Vietnamese Catholic churches. Many of them were former evangelical or Baptist churches, and they got bought out by the Vietnamese.
It's interesting too how that talking about Catholicism coming back. We opened the history with the Spaniards there with Catholicism, and it's kind of making its presence formed again. What's interesting, and this is part of the area that I know in my own research, is that when Latinos come up, there's a lot of Catholicism, as we would naturally expect, but there's a lot of evangelical Protestantism too. So this pluralism is really kind of mixing in very interesting and surprising ways.
Exactly. In fact, I talk about some of the Latino Pentecostal churches, and the one in particular in the Atlanta area that's been very influential. So yeah, that's a fascinating part of the history.
In terms of where we are today, what do you see moving forward? There's this conception of the South that was formed in the Civil War, Reconstruction era. It has its deep roots going back to the 1600s. And now we're here at the beginning of the 21st century. You mentioned all these different trends, pluralism being a new, interesting trend that is added to the mix of what the South is. If you had to project forward, saying 30, 40, 50 years in the future, how do you see religion playing out in terms of this pluralism, in terms of race relations? And do you have a somewhat optimistic or pessimistic view of how all of this is going to play out relative to where we've been historically?
Not optimistic or pessimistic, and historians are notoriously bad at projecting things into the future, so I just throw that out as a caveat. But what I do see is, number one, the deep roots of Southern white and black evangelicalism, they're not just going to go away because of pluralism. That's going to be a fundamental part of the South. And so to the degree that the South remains the Bible Belt of the nation, which I think it does demographically, a little bit less so than previous years, but still I think it's there. And that's going to be a key part of it, as will the Latino Catholics and Protestants, as will the various other immigrant groups coming in. So I think what you'll see is an interesting mixture of Southern history of the Southern evangelicals together with the Southern present and future, largely due to immigration trends, together with a kind of rural-urban divide that you would see, for example, in the research triangle of North Carolina, which I think has more PhDs per capita than any county in the country, something like that I read recently, as opposed to, let's say, a couple of counties to the eastward in North Carolina, where you would see one of them was just flooded recently, and it was a historic black community, and they're debating about, should we reestablish this community or not? Because due to climate change, this is just going to happen over and over again, and maybe we should just give up. And it's one of the most impoverished counties in the country as well. And I think that's something that's going on nationally, a national trend of sort of regional, sub-regional inequalities. I think that's going to be part of Southern history as well. So that's my pessimistic side of it, I suppose. The optimistic side is the kind of energy, creativity, and entrepreneurialism that immigrants bring when they arrive. And in many cases, immigrants have, for example, the Vietnamese case in Oklahoma City, that was a dead part of town, and they basically completely revived it. So that my optimistic side looks to that kind of thing and says that we're probably going to be okay.
We always like to end on an optimistic note here, too, and the mixture of, in the United States, of religious pluralism and the freedom that allows it to flourish, too, is a big part of our history. My guest today has been Paul Harvey. Paul, thanks for coming to Research on Religion.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.